its current state on 90.5 WKAR, and as you heard just a few moments ago on NPR, you heard about an MSU grad. Ryan Reese, Reese the Beast, has won the top prize in the poker world. He did it last night in Las Vegas. He is $8.4 million richer as a result. Now, you may also be aware that today is the day that Spartans around the world are being asked to video record what they're doing. This is part of the MSU, it's 24-360 project. And that is, think about that, that is a rare opportunity. The stars have aligned in Las Vegas for this Spartan grad. I'm wondering if he is, if the morning after he wins the top prize in poker, he will end up becoming a part of the 24-360 project. It wouldn't surprise me. Somebody's probably thought of that, I would imagine. Anyway, welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We have got a great show for you here today. Another Spartan graduate, a director who's responsible for the new documentary, Inequality for All, joins us a few minutes from now. Stay close, please. Voters re-elected Virge Bernero by a wide margin to a third term as mayor of Lansing yesterday, and they gave him what he wanted on the city council by replacing his nemesis, Brian Jeffries, with Judy Brown Clark. Now, incumbents Kathy Dunbar, Tina Houghton, and Jessica Yorko were retained, and Lansing voters also passed a measure to decriminalize marijuana. In East Lansing, appointee Kathleen Boyle won the right to fill out the balance of a term on the city council, and there will be two newcomers, Ruth Beyer and Susan Woods, on the council as well. Here to help us analyze yesterday's election result, Elaine Kulhanek, editor of Community Conversations at the Lansing State Journal. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
And Walt Sorg, longtime political observer, former Democratic candidate for the State House, who writes about local politics now for the Lansing City Pulse. Hi, Walt.
Good morning.
Good to have you both with us. Virge Bernero will serve a third term as mayor in Lansing, which doesn't surprise many. Perhaps more importantly, City Council veteran Brian Jeffries, a frequent opponent of the administration, won't be on the council. Elaine, what does that mean?
Well, it obviously gives Virge more support, although if things stay lined up the way they have been in the past 2 years, it'll be a 4-4 split, possibly. And, you know, so that gives him certainly more strength than a 5-3, but it's not complete control by any means. They'll still have to find a way to work together better than they have,
Walt?
I think.
Well, clearly it's Virge was the big winner yesterday. I found it fascinating. Brian Jeffries didn't just lose. He lost decisively in all but one precinct. He finished third, which for an incumbent is just absolutely amazing. He did carry one precinct over in the Colonial Village area, barely. But the top two women were almost neck and neck. I think the margin between the two of them was like 40 votes.
And Elaine, you've got some numbers as to how the vote broke down. Why don't you touch on that?
Well, Judy Brown Clark had 8,510 and Kathy Dunbar had 8,426. So it's a little more than 40 votes, but it was very close. And between the two of them, they did, one or the other of them won almost every precinct in the city. Brian was consistently third across the board, except for that one precinct where he did poll first. I think that was Fourth Ward Precinct 32 is what I wrote down, assuming.
Yeah, it's the Colonial Village area.
Yeah, so. And I was really surprised by that, I think other people were too. I think there were a number of folks who suspected that Brian Jeffries would be returned and that Judy Brown Clark might beat Kathy Dunbar rather than both of them getting through. So I think that is very good news for Virge, and I think it means that voters were paying attention to his message of please give me council members who will work with me.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Mayor Bernero's response to this change on the city council.
I don't need the constant griping and sniping that I get, the kind of petty stuff that we get bogged down in. And so hopefully this is a clear sign to the rest of the council that the voters have had it with that.
Walt, I'm curious, how intent do you think voters were on remaking the city council this time around? Was that really uppermost in a lot of voters' minds, or was this also a matter of just an attractive candidate, fairly well known in the community, whose time has come?
I think it was more a vote on Verge, and I think it was also his organization. I was working as a poll worker over in the Southwest side, and the only people that were out there campaigning were handing out slate tickets on behalf of the mayor with the mayor's slate of candidates, and voters were walking in with that. And I think that played a big role because Verge, as you can see, he really didn't even have serious opposition with Harold Lehman. And his popularity really helped an awful lot, but his organization helped an incredible amount as well because it's a low turnout election. We only had a 17% turnout, and organization is a big part of that. And I think it was more that than a specific time for change. The other thing I did want to mention, though, is that I felt bad for Brian Jeffries because he got slimed in some anonymous campaign attacks, which I thought were way over the line. And it's the kind of thing that we really don't need in our politics. We see it too much in city politics, especially where you get these last-minute anonymous attacks.
Were these robocalls, Walt? Robocalls or radio spots or what?
Well, there's robocalls. There was an over-the-weekend mailing that said, that had the headline, "If it smells like a rat," and referred inaccurately to an incident that happened 8 years ago that basically they misrepresented something that had happened regarding a union bug on a billboard. It made it look like that Brian was anti-union. Those sorts of things go on. And there's very little you can do about it. They were totally anonymous, which is the part I find really offensive. If candidates want to go on the attack against each other, great. Let them have at it, but admit to who's doing the attacking. When it's anonymous stuff like that, I think it's just pathetic.
Now, in the 4th Ward, we had an interesting race pitting incumbent Jessica Yorko against challenger Chong Anna Canfora. I'm wondering if voters in the 4th were also getting the cards that you saw in Southwest Lansing that just had the slate of Mayor Bernero's candidates on them. At any rate, Jessica Yorko prevailed there. Elaine, what can you tell us about the 4th?
Well, that was one of the areas of the city that had some of the highest turnout. That ward had 20% turnout, actually almost 21% turnout yesterday. And it was, by all accounts, a very hotly contested race from two, you know, vibrant candidates who probably represent the young creatives that, you know, everybody thinks that the city must appeal to. It was not necessarily that close of a race. Jessica had 2,353 votes and Chong Anna had 1,974. So, you know, I think people very clearly, you know, knew what they wanted to do there.
Walt, any indication about how concerned the Bernero camp was about Yorko losing?
Oh, there is a lot of concern about that, although I think they're feeling more comfortable in the last week. I think the key to it there was that both of them have tremendous backgrounds and qualifications for the job, but Jessica Yorko's background is more working in the community, working as a neighborhood organizer and a community organizer, and Chong Anna Canfora's camp history is more working at the state level, working as a fundraiser and as an organizer in state campaigns, and that probably tipped the balance. Plus, the Canfora campaign had a lot of negative aspects to it. On the record, she stood behind it, but that sometimes doesn't play real well.
Let's talk just briefly about newcomer Judy Brown Clark as well. What does her election mean? She was pictured with the other Bernero supporters on the mayor's Facebook page, along with Jessica Yorko, Tina Houghton, and Kathy Dunbar. She's obviously seen as being in the mayor's camp. Elaine?
Yeah, I think that, you know, like everybody, even, you know, Kathy and Tina and Jessica will all say they don't agree with the mayor on everything. And I'm certain she has not promised to agree with the mayor on everything. But I think that she will be a fresh voice. I think she's wonderfully qualified, very energetic, very well educated, great discipline, you know, in her personal and professional life, obviously from her record as an Olympic athlete all the way through to her educational achievements and professional achievements, really a stellar candidate. And I think she will be a big breath of fresh air on the council.
Walt, care to weigh in on Judy Brown Clark?
Yeah, an interesting sign was she did not participate in the group hug party last night down at the Nut House, which had the rest of the Bernero slate there, including the mayor and three council candidates. She had her own party about two blocks down the street, which I thought was interesting. A lot of people I've talked to say that this is the beginning of the Judy Brown Clark for mayor campaign.
What, is there any indication? Go ahead, Elaine.
I heard that from someone yesterday, too. And I just think that there's been a 8 years of bickering and infighting between the mayor and the council, and I think that a lot of people in the community, including influential people in the business, in leadership community, would like to see the city move beyond that. And when you see such a highly qualified candidate, you see a prospect there. It does not surprise me that people are already, mentioning the mayor word with her name.
Here is a question that has not come up on this program, and I need to ask it now. Is it known that whether or not the Bernero administration reached out to Judy Brown Clark and tried to recruit her as a candidate? Do we know that?
Yes, she was encouraged by the mayor to run, and she was encouraged to run at large. At one point, she was considering running in the 4th Ward. She does not consider herself a Verge candidate. She was the one candidate who had the United Support of Labor, which is interesting. What I found impressive about Judy in the interviews we did for the City Pulse editorial endorsements was she's got a really good understanding of human dynamics and how to get people to work together. And that probably dates back to her days as an athlete, where even though she was an individual track star, she was a part of a team as well. And I think that has the potential for her to play very well. If she can be a unifying force in the city, that would be a real breath of fresh air, given all the histrionics we've had between the 9th and the 10th floor.
How influential was her spouse in this, Judge Hugh Clark? I mean, did he play a role in mobilizing a lot of votes here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely in the background. No question that there was a very heavy African-American vote. I was working in a precinct that was predominantly African-American, and she won that one very heavily. But that's not to say that she was the black candidate for council, because she won most precincts in the city of the three candidates. She and Kathy Dunbar split them up, and it didn't really matter where it was. But certainly... The fact that her husband is really well wired into the political establishment locally, that helped quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that gives her a leg up in context and background and things. But I think she's a force to be reckoned with, and she will tell you is when their youngest is approaching the stage of eventually leaving the nest, and she looked across the living room at Hugh and said, "Boy, I got to find something to do." She will say that.
It is going to be very interesting to see how her voting record plays out, though, here. She appeared with the mayor and Yorko Houghton and Dunbar in the mayor's Facebook page. But, I mean, they all claim not to disagreeing with the mayor on occasion. It's just going to be very interesting to watch how her voting record actually plays out, won't it, Walt?
Oh, absolutely. But I think it's going to be more the dynamics of how the people get along. The fact that she was able to get the full labor endorsement, I think, is really very important in a contested race like that. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, so she had both the UAW and the Labor Council, is what you're saying.
Right.
And the Labor Council were the folks who lined up with Jeffries and Camfora, and the UAW lined up with the mayor's slate. So she got them both, and that is a big deal.
That sounds like she could be a person in the middle on a lot of issues.
I think, yeah, her influence is going to be very important on the council.
Let's move on to marijuana decriminalization. The measure on the ballot was approved by a 20-point margin. Did passage surprise you, Elaine Kolhanek, or did the margin surprise you? What do you take away from this?
The margin did not surprise me. Passage did not surprise me. What it actually means on the ground for people who want to smoke a joint, I don't really have a clue, because I clearly state law is still in place. And I saw somebody interviewed on TV last night, actually in Jackson, which passed the same law, saying our police don't want to lose their state and federal funding, so they are going to keep enforcing state and federal law, even though it passed. Now I don't know how it'll actually play out everywhere, but very confusingly written too, because less than an ounce, but the criminal statutes are written in grams. Not ounces, and so it's really hard to get your arms around how many people were arrested in Lansing last year who wouldn't be arrested under this, because they don't track the statistics that way.
Okay, let's listen now to Jeff Hank, an attorney who was the chief organizer of the decriminalization campaign. Here he is last night.
This is a historic night. I think it's a landslide by all considerations. It sends a message not only to our local politicians, but to the politicians at the state level that it's time to do something.
Walt Sorg, what do you make of the decriminalization vote?
Oh, that's exactly what it was. Send them a message. In terms of the actual impact in the city of Lansing, it means nothing. The prosecutor wasn't interested in these cases anyway, and if Stuart Dunnings isn't interested, nothing's going to happen on prosecution. But it does send a message across the street to the state capitol building.
But it sounds like it does not resolve any number of enforcement questions on the ground, as Elaine alluded to.
Well, enforcement's up to the prosecutor. If the prosecutor doesn't want the case, the police aren't going to waste their time making the arrest. It's as simple as that. And Stuart Dunnings has not indicated any great desire to handle simple possession cases. If it comes up as an ancillary charge and something more serious, it might show up. But I think as a practical matter, it really doesn't mean anything. We're not going to have a hash bash down on the state capitol steps.
Let's talk about the second ward, Tina Houghton and Charles Hoffmeyer, to get back to the city council contest. Houghton, really no problem there. He had some interesting numbers, though, Elaine, as far as the turnout goes in the second.
Yeah, second ward was really low turnout, 15%, and also had, this is just sad, and I'm second ward precinct 21, and we had pretty good turnout in my precinct, but second ward precinct 16, shame on you, 6.5% turnout.
Wow.
Lowest turnout in the city, I believe.
What did you make of the contest there in the second, Walt?
There wasn't one. Charles Hoffmeyer didn't stage a campaign. His campaign consisted basically of getting on the ballot and then setting up a website. He didn't do door-to-door, didn't do yard signs, didn't do any advertising, didn't do any mailing, was showed up occasionally at neighborhood associations. The funny part is when I wrote about it in City Pulse, he sent me a very angry email after I said that he basically had dropped out of the campaign. But he wasn't doing anything that a candidate does. Very nice man, very well-intentioned, but there was never a question about Tina. Mark, I know we're running short of time. One thing that I did want to get into, I think it's really very significant. We had several millage proposals on the ballot around Ingham County, and they all passed.
Yes, yes. Okemos, Williamston.
Yeah,
were a couple.
Yeah, it was a sinking fund for maintenance in Williamston. Weberville was for maintenance. Perry, their entire operating millage was up for renewal. Without that, they would have probably dropped athletics and buses, but those both passed very overwhelmingly. And then Okemos really supported a proposal to extend the current millage so they go out and basically equip every student with a tablet, probably an iPad, which is something that's happening more and more in education. It's kind of been one of my pet projects on the side is promoting that sort of thing. But the Okemos vote was over 70%. And then one other vote that I thought was fascinating, in Charlotte, they had a city income tax on the ballot. It went down 4-1.
Holy cow. Okay.
And the city council member who was one of those who put it on the ballot was running for mayor, and he got beat.
For the record, we will point out that Susan Woods and Ruth Beyer in East Lansing replaced Vic Loomis and Kevin Baird on the city council, and Kathleen Boyd, who was also an appointee, won election to fill the balance of her term. We want to thank Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody for help with the audio here on this morning's segment, and we want to thank both of our guests. Elaine Culhannock is Community Conversations Editor at the Lansing State Journal. Walt Sorg writes about local politics for the Lansing City Pulse. Elaine and Walt, thank you.
Have a great day. I'm going back to bed.
Thanks.
Well, the 16th East Lansing Film Festival begins tonight with the documentary Inequality for All. This movie features former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich as he seeks to address the widening American income gap. It's won awards at the Sundance Film Festival and at the Traverse City Film Festival. Inequality for All was directed by MSU graduate Jacob Kornbluth, who's in town for tonight's screening, and he joins us now in Current State. Welcome back to town.
Well, thanks for having me.
How long has it been since you've been back in East Lansing?
You know, too long. It's actually been quite a walk down memory lane to go try and put piece back together my college experience.
When did you graduate?
I'm a class of 94.
Okay.
So a long time ago.
All right. Yeah. Let's start by hearing part of the theatrical trailer to Inequality for All, which gives voice to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich and his ideas about income inequality in America. He worked under Presidents Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter.
Of all developed nations, the United States has the most unequal distribution of income, and we're surging toward even greater inequality. 1928 and 2007 become the peak years for income concentration. It looks like a suspension bridge.
Last year, we made $36,000.
I probably make $50,000 a year, working 70 hours a week.
The middle class is struggling.
Now, people occasionally say to me, what nation does it better? The answer is the United States. In the decades after World War II, the economy boomed, but you had very low inequality.
Do you know Robert Reich?
I do indeed.
He's a communist.
So tell us about working with Robert Reich.
Well, it was just an absolute honor and a pleasure, actually, to work with him. He's funny, which is something that you don't necessarily get from seeing him if you've seen him as a pundit on TV. And I really shared that sense of humor, and he's got this real with him, and he has this real sort of natural warmth about him that's that makes him sort of uniquely suited to be a guide for a topic like this.
And how much did the subject matter appeal to you as a filmmaker?
Well, the subject matter for me is I really think of this widening income inequality that we've been seeing in America over the last, say, 40 years or so is the defining issue of our times. It's certainly the most important one to me. It matters the most to me because I'm worried about my own economic state just about every day. Me and my friends constantly talk about what we're going to do about money. And so what the state of our economy is was deeply important for me to understand. About 2008 or so, after the economy crashed, I sort of decided that even though I'm not an economist and I don't have an economics degree or background, I actually graduated from the communications department here at MSU, but that this was something that I needed to know what was going on. I needed to know what was going on with the economy. So I set out to make this film because I couldn't think of anything else more important to do. It seems like the most important thing that it was what I was most worried about is what I can tell. I grew up poor too, and got to come to MSU on a financial aid scholarship, and certainly grew up with a keen awareness of who gets what in a society. And to see the way that the story was playing out, none of it was explaining it to me. I sort of didn't have a sense of what had happened to our economy from watching the news and reading, even though I watch the news and read a lot. I didn't really get it. And one of the proudest things in my mind for me about this film is that my wife, who's a school teacher and doesn't usually like economics and politics, she loves this movie, and not necessarily just because her husband made it, but because she, for the first time, feels like she gets it. She understands sort of what's going on. So that made me happy because that's really what I made the film for.
Your previous two feature-length films are fiction, Haiku Tunnel and The Best Thief in the World. What was that transition like going from fiction to nonfiction documentary?
You know, it didn't really feel like that different to me, honestly. I mean, I believe passionately in the power of story, and I applied that same passion to the fiction and the nonfiction work that I've done. I care a lot about, and I've spent the last 15 years of my life worrying about the story mechanics. How do you tell a story properly? Mm-hmm. And all that stuff applied to documentaries. There was certainly differences to making a documentary. This is my first doc, and it's a lot slower to make a documentary. You're shooting stuff all the time, and you're getting to know a character in a way that's different than writing a script and shooting it in a short period of time as you do in a fiction film. But the storytelling felt to me remarkably similar, and I felt like it was some of the best training that you could have for a documentary to have worked in screenwriting and fiction filmmaking.
Very interesting. Let's get back to Inequality for All. Without giving too much away, what's Secretary Reich's premise here? How is it this state of affairs, this inequality, has become so dominant?
Well, how it's become so dominant is the subject of the movie, and it takes a while to describe. But the premise of the movie is that this is bad for everyone, that widening income inequality isn't about us versus them. For instance, the working class versus the rich or vice versa. Like, we have to be afraid of the other guy. The premise is that this really does hurt all of us, so that even the rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than they are now with a larger share of an economy that's basically stagnant and going nowhere. So if we can change that framing from, boy, this is about who the bad guys are, and we're going to go get, say, the evil rich people holding us down, mm-hmm. and to, we're all in this together, and we'd be better off, including the rich, if this inequality were fixed. That's a massive change in the way we see the problem. And what you can see when you look at history is that when inequality was less, say in the three decades after the Second World War, as our clip showed at the beginning of the segment, you can see that when inequality was less, the economy grew. We saw the largest economic expansion in America, possibly in world history, when economic inequality in America was less. And as economic inequality grows, and at the peak of economic inequality was 1928 and 2007, when the rich have too much and the economy is just that out of balance, what ends up happening is the economy crashes. It did in 1929 for the Great Depression, and it did in 2008 for the Great Recession. So this isn't just a problem for some. It's not just a problem of, us versus them. It's about we're all in it together.
We're talking with MSU graduate, movie director Jacob Kornbluth, who is in East Lansing for a screening tonight of his new documentary, Inequality for All. Did you cover the Occupy movement in the movie all?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Actually, the genesis of this film actually predates the Occupy movement, which was fascinating because when you first started talking about this film, people said, oh, economic inequality, isn't that a cute little idea that you have over there for the movie? And then it sort of blew up on the national scene when the Occupy movement sort of emerged. So I watched that happen as the film was getting made, and I was curious how this film would land in the sort of – well, it turns out it's more relevant than ever. I mean, right now in 2000 – right as we sit today, as we sit here talking – the recession that ended supposedly in a few years ago, since it's ended, at 95% of the gains since the recession ended have gone to the top 1% here in America. So what you've seen is economic inequality skyrocketing again. And this was the story before the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement, I think, was an incredibly important movement to focus this issue in the national attention for the first time. But it really didn't have the... to my mind anyway, the sort of organization and discipline to affect the kind of change that I would have liked to have seen done. So I'm hoping that some of the folks who are motivated by issues like that can now re-engage with the problem and maybe try and fix it.
In terms of who comes to see this documentary, who do you expect will be interested in this? And kind of a follow-up question, do you ever feel as if you're preaching to the choir here?
Sure. No, it's a good question. Well, first of all, we had the good fortune to be picked up by a great distributor, the Weinstein Company, and he's got a great track record of getting films like this in front of people who wouldn't ordinarily see it. And we had the good fortune of playing this film in over 100 cities across America already. And it's gotten great reviews in places I wouldn't have expected, places like Mississippi and Tulsa and parts of the country that are certainly more conservative, where if there is a choir, it's a very small one. Mm-hmm. but there's always a challenge with an issue like this. I'd say that when people hear the topic, the title, Inequality for All, I don't think you get a sense of what I think is a very entertaining film. And pretty consistently, I run into people at the screenings whose friend dragged them to the screening, and they're like, oh, I thought this was going to be like taking my medicine. And then they watch the movie and they say, this is my favorite movie, and I really get a sense. So There's certainly a motivated choir that I think should see this film, because I think they're who helps get their friends to go to see it who aren't in that choir.
Okay.
And we've seen it start from the choir and spread out. It's an easy way to say it.
Do you hear from conservatives about this movie?
Oh, yeah.
Do you expect to? They see them.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. So they see. You know, I hear it's been remarkably civil, my discussions with conservatives about this film. And I have to say that's been heartening, because so much of what you hear about when you hear about the news or in the zeitgeist is how polarized we are and how it's impossible to talk across the ideological divide. And the conservatives who I've engaged with on this film, you know, they're worried about this too. Mm-hmm. Just because you're conservative, nobody likes the facts of how the economic distribution is right now. So nobody's like that, not even conservatives.
So, between the lines, what you're hearing is there is a point at which income needs to be more evenly distributed throughout society.
You know, there's a couple of things that you hear. You hear that this isn't necessarily just a left-wing issue, mm-hmm. that conservatives are mm-hmm. worried about it too. I think that there's a different sense, and my frustration with the conservative point of view is, frankly, that they tend to think of this as sort of economic determinism, like this is just like the weather. The economy is just like the weather. But we make the rules of the economy, and the economy should be for us, not for, you know, it didn't just happen.
Jacob Kornbluth is the director of Inequality for All, the documentary that launches this year's East Lansing Film Festival. Tonight at 7:30 at the Studio C Theaters in Okemos, he'll be there for the screening. The festival's schedule includes a talk with the filmmaker Justin Leach, an environmental panel discussion, and a filmmaker's roundtable discussion on Saturday. Find the complete schedule at elff.com. Jacob, thank you very much. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday. It's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature the Art for Charlie Foundation. The organization, based here in East Lansing, raises money to support hospice care for children and to help families coping with the loss of a child. Here to tell us more about the Art for Charlie Foundation is the co-founder and Charlie's father, John Waller. Welcome to Current State, John.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Certainly. Tell us about how the Art for Charlie Foundation came about.
The origins of this foundation really go back to April the 1st, 2011, when my wife and I took our son, Charlie, he was then 2 years old, to the Sparrow Hospital after he'd been having a number of problems. And they performed an MRI, and we were told within about 15 minutes we were called into the discussion area, and Dr. Steve Girton told us with a really gentle honesty that he had about the worst kind of cancer of all. He had an inoperable brainstem tumor that is almost invariably fatal. And in the weeks and months after receiving that news, we decided that we had to do something to bring the community in, but also to make up for an absence in the community, in the area, that Charlie's condition highlighted, and that was the absence of hospice care and facilities for young children.
And have you learned why there's been that lack up until this point, or why that's been a problem?
Obviously, a major reason is that far fewer young children die young or experiencing serious life-limiting illnesses than do adults. And of course, there are always major financial obstacles to getting these kinds of programs underway. But at the same time, the hospice movement has been gathering momentum for 40, 50 years now. It's made enormous strides. And the needs of children to receive specialized hospice care are being widely recognized. And programs are developing all over the country. all over Western Europe as well. And in fact, in Michigan as well, there's been a big push in recent years to get these, to get the hospice services actually provided. At the Sparrow, also Hospice of Michigan has been pushing hard. So in many ways, us starting to raise money for this, the timing has been rather fortuitous because the need was felt and there was already the enthusiasm, the sense of need within the hospitals to actually do something about this, to meet this important need.
What kind of start are you off to with the Art for Charlie Foundation?
So in the summer of 2011, we had our first major fundraiser for hospice services. And that was a wonderful success. We've got better and bigger over the years. So last year in November is hospice month, we had a wonderful, a really spectacular art show at the Marriott in downtown East Lansing. And that raised over $50,000 as a result of a small army of wonderful community volunteers. The donations, really generous donations of artists, amateur and professional, from Michigan, from America more broadly, and also from about four different continents. We also had fantastic sponsorship for the show, and the Marriott did a terrific job in creating a really impressive, beautiful show. And that really made us fully committed for the future to continue with this. And so the next show is next Thursday, also at the Marriott, and we hope to raise even more.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly has the money that you've raised so far, what's that gone toward?
So last year we donated $20,000 to the Sparrow. And what the Sparrow has done is created a pilot program through the generosity of a number of pediatric nurses who really wanted to do this. They wanted training in hospice, and they wanted to be able to provide expert palliative care for children at home. So the children were always being well looked after. There could always be a nurse who could be called upon and a doctor whose advice could be consulted. And also that they could later be looked after in the hospital, but they could be at home for as long as possible. And so a number of nurses trained, and part of the money that we donated was spent on this retraining to get this pilot program underway. We've also donated $10,000 to Hospice of Michigan, which has a brilliant program. They provide nursing care, hospice nursing care, but also social workers who will come to your house. They also have a program they're setting up in East Michigan so that families who are experiencing significant problems, maybe financial distress because of the sickness of a child, maybe bereavement, they can actually draw on these services as well.
We're talking with John Waller, the founder of the Art for Charlie Foundation, whose next event is coming up soon. Tell us about your son, Charlie. What's he like? How is his health now?
A very good friend and colleague here at the university once said to me that Charlie, even though he has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, that he is the greatest affirmation of life he's ever met. Mm. I think Charlie is probably the most precociously kind child or probably person I've ever met. He's enormously empathetic. His understanding of the feeling of others is quite extraordinary. At the same time, he's a rambunctious little boy. He's perfectly happy trying to beat up his sister. But it's his love which it really, really screams out. And it doesn't matter whether it's a bug or it's a human being. He's a boy of extraordinary gentleness and sympathy.
And curiosity, it sounds like.
Enormously, yeah. And throughout this extremely difficult 2.5 year period, he has barely complained. He lives life with such a passion that people just warm to him enormously. And the fact that we've got this foundation set up and the fact that we've been able to get through the last 2.5 years is to a large extent a testament to the strength of community in the mid-Michigan area. People's kindnesses have been almost infinite. It's been really remarkable. But I think part of it is also that Charlie has the kind of personality that he's such a remarkable little boy that he just draws people in. Mm-hmm. He makes friends incredibly easily and quickly, and they're firm friendships with adults and children.
And how is he doing right now?
Well, Charlie has had an amazing 2.5 years. The care at the Sparrow was absolutely wonderful. He received radiation at the cancer center, extremely well looked after. Then he received several weeks of steroids, and that was a very difficult time. But they gave us our son back, and we've had a most wonderful time, sad, but also frequently exhilarating. Last week, his headaches began to increase again, and things have unraveled very, very quickly in the last few days. Thursday night, it took enormous courage for him to go trick-or-treating. He's obsessed with Halloween and pirates, but he did it. He came home and then he was very sick. He had an MRI on Friday that showed that the tumor was growing again. Saturday, he could walk around a little bit. Sunday, he was virtually immobile on the sofa. The last 2 days, he's been a little bit more engaged, but we know that time is now very short. And I think we've sometimes wondered whether we're doing the right thing, taking on all the work of helping to run a foundation at this stage. We no longer have any doubt that this next week's event has so much importance and feels so profoundly right, because he's now benefiting from the hospice services that we are going to spend the rest of our lives trying to foster and fund.
You've been chronicling all of this online at friendsofcharlie.com. Yeah. It's very personal. Why did you and your wife decide to make this situation so public?
I've always been one of those people who, when a tragedy happens to somebody else, I've cared deeply but been terrified of saying the wrong thing. Whether I imagined that I brought up the topic when they were trying not to think about it, or whether my words just lacked the eloquence, or maybe they came out without the sincerity I felt. And we were very concerned early on. We're obviously not locals. What would happen? Well, we realized the importance of bringing people in. But what most heartened us was how little effort we needed to make to bring people in. Our close friends became much closer. Mere acquaintances and strangers are now among our closest friends and the dearest supporters of Charlie as well. Terminal illness, particularly with a child, can be so alienating and isolating because it frightens people. I remember Abby saying the night of his diagnosis, that everybody would be going home that evening and holding their children tighter. But we knew that people would be upset by it and some people would want to stay away. So that was really the initial impulse, was to bring people into this story, because we were not going to be able to survive it without them. And Charlie would gain enormously by having people who were looking out for him. And he's received enormous support.
After hearing your story, I'm sure there are many of our listeners who would like to participate in this upcoming event. Tell us again the basics of the event and how people can attend.
Yes, I very, very much encourage people to attend. It's obviously a very, very sad inspiration, but it's a very wonderful evening. So it's at the downtown Marriott in East Lansing. It starts at 6 p.m. next Thursday evening. We have wonderful artwork from all around the world, but also what's really, really pleased us this year is how many local artists have come forward and donated superb artwork. So most of the work will be donated as part of a silent auction, but Jason Colthorpe will also be hosting a live auction segment. And he did it last year, and he did it with incredible wit and charm. We also have many non-art donations. One of my favorites is Hopcat, the restaurant that's recently opened in East Lansing, has donated a really generous gift of a whole day spent learning about their food and also their fluids, and getting on a bus, going to Grand Rapids, spending an entire day learning about beer, brewing, and also sampling food. Let me also mention that there is a kids' art show running from Tuesday to Thursday in the lobby of the Marriott. Lots and lots of local schools, thousands of school children have contributed to what is going to be a wonderful display of artwork. So that's from Tuesday to Thursday.
Very good. And the website again is?
www.artforcharlie.org. You can buy tickets through the website, also through Schuller's bookstore. So they'd be very generously agreed to be ticket sellers for us.
Artforcharlie.org. John Waller is the co-founder of the Art for Charlie Foundation, which works to improve access to palliative care for children. Thank you very much, John, for taking time to join us during a difficult time. We wish you and your family the best.
Thank you very much indeed.
Current state on WKAR, Detroit Symphony Orchestra conductor Emeritus Naimi Järvi returns to the Michigan stage this Friday night. He'll conduct the Estonian National Orchestra at East Lansing's Wharton Center. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with the Estonian native about his homeland's music and Friday's program.
It started actually from Estonian radio. And the Estonian radio, three people, and then five people, and then 10 people, and all the depends, of course, everything from finances and money and everything, and understanding how much culture is important. And the Estonians slowly but surely don't very much show our culture, our heritage. And during different regimes, we still went on and on and on until orchestra became really big, wonderful. During that period came a lot of interesting people to conduct the orchestra. Even Stravinsky came to Estonia.
A very important Estonian composer will figure in the program that you'll present in Michigan, as the program will begin with the Overture No. 2 by Veljo Tormish, composer that might not be completely familiar to all of our audiences here in Michigan, but one of the most important choral composers of our time. He is known for his film scores, his orchestral music, very prolific, very compelling, beautiful music at times, strong folk music connections. You've recorded his Overture No. 2 with the Scottish National Orchestra. I think that listeners are really going to be grabbed by this piece and like it very much. There's almost a cinematic quality to it.
Influenced by one great Estonian composer, Edward Tubin. You know, in Russia there is Shostakovich. Our Shostakovich is Edward Tubin, but not Shostakovich type of human music, but completely different. It's a really great symphonist. So Tormis was one of them who you feel the sort of Nordic approach, and you feel this Nordic music. That's going to be in the program. What else in the program?
After the overture, we have the Dvorak Cello Concerto with Nari Kokhnazarian.
Yeah.
The Tchaikovsky competition winner. How did you connect with him, and what does he bring to the Dvorak Concerto?
I think it is a very 25-year-old young man.
Yeah.
And Armenian.
Yes.
And it's very nice to hear as a national presenting from the other republic, which... very talented young man, and doing his career properly, for surely, in a very right direction. And he is a cellist, doesn't have much repertoire, you know.
Right.
Which kind of repertoire we playing? Of course, Dvorak. But Dvorak is one of my favorite composers also, because I have recorded all symphonies and all tone poems and everything by Dvorak. Wonderful continuation of some kind of Brahmsian type music. And of course, Dvorak later came to America and left a lot of influences from here. And this piece is written in America. And that's an American piece, Dvorak Cello Concerto.
Yes.
And it is one of the highlights of his music.
And then your tour includes typically an opening work and then a concerto, a major symphony. Sometimes on your tour, it's Brahms' Second, Tchaikovsky's Fifth in Michigan. I'm so glad you're going to play the Sibelius Fifth. Nothing against Brahms or Tchaikovsky.
I personally have done 19 CDs by Sibelius music.
Mm-hmm.
By this recording, I think it is necessary to introduce Sibelius any place to the world. Some people appreciate it, that some people doesn't know that, but you have to be persuasive enough to explain this is good music and this is a great music.
I'm a huge Sibelius fan, and Arvo Pärt is one of my favorite composers. I wish you were playing his music here in Michigan, maybe next time.
No, we can play as encore.
Perfect.
If you clap well. Tell your audience we have to listen Arvo Pärt, and we have it in the repertoire. No problem.
I'll spread the word and lead the charge. Maestro, welcome back to Michigan. Neeme Järvi is Music Director of the Estonian National Orchestra, Music Director Emeritus of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Maestro, thanks again.
Thank you very much. All the best.
For Current State, this is Peter Warf.
That's our show. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.